This is Radioactive, a weekly grassroots environmental and social justice news journal for August 1st, 2013. This is Meredith DeFrancesco. This week, thousands of fast food workers across the country went on strike for better wages, calling for a $15 minimum wage per hour and the right to unionize. The Fast Food Forward campaign began in New York City and has spread across the United States. Fast food workers also went on strike in New York City this past November and April. Today we turn to a part of a panel presentation in New York on June 9th at the Left Forum. The panel was titled, Foundations of Economic Justice, Low-Wage Workers Forward. Among the panelists were two KFC workers involved in the Fast Food Forward campaign. The panel was moderated and organized by Richard Hill of WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut. We begin with Michael Zwig, professor of economics at Stony Brook University and the director of the Center for the Study of Working Class Life. He's the author of The Working Class Majority.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's good to be here at the Left Forum again in 2013. The years keep rolling along, and here we are. 7 minutes, let me see what I can do, just sort of, as the Chinese say, going from mountaintop to mountaintop, peering down at the valleys below where all the interesting stuff is happening. So just some principal points of orientation to the discussion that I think are important. Number one, if we understand that a class structure of the society is something other than income, where we have the rich, middle, and poor, but understand class dynamics in terms of a capitalist class, a working class, and a middle class that's kind of in between those power grids of labor and capital, poverty emerges as something quite different from a group of people who are stuck at the bottom of society, the poor, who, as the Bible says, will always be with us, and there they are. I think that what's important for us to understand is that poverty is something that happens to the working class, and that it does not lend itself to the best analysis by thinking of the poor as some marginal other. That, I think, is the takeaway that I would want to contribute here. Poverty is something that happens to the working class, and if you're concerned about poverty, the concern should be directed towards improving the conditions of labor and improving the organizational capacity of working people to advance their own interests collectively, whether that's in the form of unions or politically or community organizations or in whatever way is available. That is where the action needs to be. I just have a few pieces of information that I want to throw into this. Coming out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics in 2011, if you look at the labor force as a whole, the working poor, that is, the people who are poor but who are working at least 27 weeks a year, at least half time, are 7% of the labor force. 7% of the labor force in the United States are working poor. So that's a substantial number of people. Two-thirds of poor families had at least one person working for at least 27 weeks in the year. Two-thirds of all poor families. So what we're talking about here, again, is not some marginal other, but something that is the phenomenon of work, and particularly low-paid work, work that's interrupted by periods of unemployment, work that is very precarious, and that is reflected, again, the phenomenon of poverty and work, poverty in the working class, in what is sometimes called cycling in and out of poverty. People tend sometimes to think, well, if you think of rich, middle, and poor, there's a broad middle class with a fringe of rich and a fringe of poor. And the poor, you know, it could be 12%, 14% of the population. It's more or less always the same rough number. And so that conveys the idea that those are the same people year after year. But it's not the same people. And when I wrote The Working Class Majority and looked into this in the late 90s, what I found was a Harvard study that demonstrated that over a 10-year period, 40% of the working population experienced poverty in at least 1 year. So again, people are poor, then they're not poor. They are laid off. They go through a divorce, and the woman finds herself in a precarious situation. And then in a year or two, the situation is recovered, and they're not poor anymore. So over a 10-year period, 40% of the labor force experiences poverty. That was an older study, and I did find a reference to a new study by Melissa Botich at the Center for American Progress, which demonstrated that recently, in four-year periods, in any four-year period, a third of the labor force experiences poverty in at least 1 year. So if we think of the labor force now in terms of class, capitalist class, a middle class, and a working class, what I found, and I'm not going to defend it here, but just to assert it, that about 63% of the labor force are working class people. The capitalists are about 2% in that power relationship, and then the middle class, about 35% of professional people, small business owners, and managers and supervisors. So it turns out that for the most part, poverty is going to be happening to people who are in that working class community. Some managers and some small business owners will experience poverty, and I'll get to that number in a moment. But if a third of the labor force experiences poverty within a four-year period, and two-thirds of the labor force is the working class, that means that roughly half the working class in this country experiences poverty within a four-year period. So when we're talking about poverty, we really need to understand that it is a central experience of working people in this country. So who is it who are poor? Well, of course, we know it's disproportionately Black, Hispanic, women. But I want to make a point here, again, of an important point of orientation. Poverty is disproportionately felt in the African-American community. About 25% poverty rate in the African-American community, about 8% poverty rate in the white community. So poverty is three times more prevalent in the Black community than it is in the white community. But two-thirds of all poor people in the United States are white. Three-quarters of all Black people in the United States are not poor. So often, if we just have poverty as just in terms of income, and we have the rich, middle, and poor, and you think of class that way, it's very easy to conflate poverty with race. And that's a big mistake. Even though it is true that poverty is disproportionately felt in the African-American community, and that's a serious problem of racism that we should not overlook. Simply to leave it at that ignores the fact that two-thirds of all poor people in the United States are white. And if all your program and all your attention is paid to African-Americans when we talk about poverty, there's an awful lot of white people who are saying, wait a minute, what about me? And they have a point. So we really do need to keep that in mind. So who are these poor people? Again, from BLS data, Bureau of Labor Statistics, a third of all poor people, working poor this is, are in service occupations. Only a third. I was really surprised when I saw that number. I expected it to be much higher than that. But about a third, about 23%, a little less than a quarter, are in sales and office professions. About 25% are in construction and other blue-collar work. And about 10 or 12% are in the management, professional, and related categories. So small business owners, some lawyers or doctors or nurses who are laid off and or who have difficulties. So there is some representation of poverty within the sort of managerial professional America, but that's about a third of the labor force, and it's only about 10% of the poor population. So it's much underrepresented, although it's not absent completely. So if we're looking again at the geographical spread of poverty, we need to understand that the demographics of the country are changing, and people are moving out of the well-to-do people, rich people, are moving out of the suburbs and into the cities. We know it here in New York as gentrification. It's going on all over the country. But what's happening is that poverty is being suburbanized. And we have this idea that the poor are only in the inner cities and the suburbs are where everybody is cool. That is not any longer really the case. So when we think about poverty in the suburbs, extra problems emerge because there's no transportation systems there. There's no easy access to medical facilities in the suburbs. There are no jobs. The mismatch of geographical location of jobs with where people live is a severe problem in this distribution of the poor. And I think that, again, just in 7 minutes to close off, to come back to the point that if we really want to understand poverty, we need to understand the conditions of work and of working people. And if we want to address the poor, as so many religious institutions do, including this Pope, who we have now, Pope Francis, who presents himself as someone with great concern for the poor. Terrific. Let's show that concern for the poor with concern for the working class. Let's show that concern for the poor for the transformational power of working people organized to address the institutions that structure the economy in such a way that poverty is reproduced from year to year and takes the characteristics that we see here. I'll finish with that and we'll go on and see where the discussion leads us.
You are listening to Radioactive. On a week that fast food workers across the country have gone on strike, we hear from a panel on low-wage workers recorded at the Left Forum in New York City this summer. Shanita Simon is a KFC worker in New York City. She affiliates herself with New York Communities for Change.
We're delighted that Shanita Simon could step in for Alteryk Hall, who got called to the West Coast for another labor action. And Shanita is a Kentucky Fried Chicken worker, and she's going to basically tell us what it's like to be a Kentucky Fried Chicken worker and how she got involved with these fast food actions.
My name is Shanita Simon. I work at 1667 Pickens Avenue. I've been a shift supervisor for about almost 2 years. I got promoted within my first 3 months of getting hired. I was pretty excited. Going to work was, you know, it was something to do every day. It was something to learn. It was, you know, something to, I was able to learn something and then teach someone else. You know, it was pretty exciting at first, but then when you start to get violated, the only thing you start to worry about is the money. And I feel when you're held accountable for your actions, when you do something wrong, I feel when somebody does something wrong to you, they should be held accountable as well, no matter how big, how small they are. I think people are taking advantage of their power, and it's not fair. For example, for my first year of working, I used to work off the clock. You know, we would be understaffed, and, you know, my manager will call and say, it's 1 o'clock in the morning, you're still on the clock? Yeah, my job is not done. I'm the only person here to finish the work. I will have to finish cooking, finish washing dishes, and still cash the orders. And get off the clock, you know, late. It's called labor forecast. Labor is high, you know, labor versus sales. My sales are low, I have to get off the clock. So if they're not making the money, they can't pay me. You know, so which is another issue that, you know, we were having. If the managers throughout the whole company are not depositing their sale money, you know, the first come, first serve when it comes to checks. You know, if she gets paid first, I get paid more, I can't deposit my check because then it will bounce. You know, such issues like that. Issues as far as I used to work 60 hours a week, you know, various weeks, and I would have my check split, you know, because they don't want to pay me overtime. So they will pay me 20 hours regular pay on my next check and 40 hours this week. They have no problem paying me 40 hours, but no overtime. And soon as, you know, you're not doing something to please into their eye, you're reduced in hours. So I can have 40 hours, no problem, this week, and then have 20 hours the next week because I spoke my mind. That's another thing. You're not allowed to speak out your differences. You have to keep your opinion to yourself. You came here to work, and that's it. You know, when you see someone doing something wrong, you can't say anything. you know, is now that I'm a supervisor and we're teaching, we're not bringing the new employees. When we're teaching them something, we teach them the wrong way and we teach them the right way. Because if they see the manager doing something, it's monkey see, monkey do. So if you see the manager doing something wrong, you tend to follow that manager. And then when inspection time come or, you know, the KFC corporate come and visit, it's like, okay, why is that new employee doing something wrong? So they know, okay, when KFC corporate is here, you do what's right. When KFC corporate is not there, you know, we follow regular routine. And I really think that it should be one way, the right way. You know, things as far as letting people go home for 2 hours. I know it's illegal. You're supposed to work for 3 hours, at least 3 hours, and then, you know, go home. My workers, I'm not allowed to send my workers on break, which, I, you know, they come to me, you know, Shanita, I'm hungry. Can I go on break? I'm sorry, honey. You know, we're short staff. I can't send you on break right now. But what I can do is, you know, step aside for 5 minutes and get something to eat. I would try to hold down the floor here by myself. And I look at them in sympathy because I experienced that for 3 months as well as a cashier, as a you know, beginning cook, as a beginning prep. You know, it's a lot of things that I'm forced to do that it's not fair to my employees, but I'm authorized to do. You know, and I don't do it, I get in trouble. You know, and it's a lot of things that I'm being blamed for, like, as far as, like, we just had food inspection and I feel, you know, terribly. And I do take responsibility for those actions, but everything that we failed for, as far as, okay, we didn't have the repairman come and fix the door, or we have graffiti on the side of the wall, I'm getting blamed for. So a lot of things is called write-up. You know, you get 3 write-ups and you're fired. I already have 2 for things that has nothing to do with me. So, you know, my next write-up, they already gave me a warning. We're going to have inspection again. If you fail, that's it. That's your job. You know, which I have no problem taking accountability for my actions, but don't blame me for something that I have no responsibility for, and I can't, it's out of my hands. You know, so that's basically what's going on in my store. The campaign goals, my goal for this campaign is to see change. It's time for change. When I first got hired, I had no knowledge of what should be done, what shouldn't be done, what was fair and what was not fair. I was a new employee, and to, you know, stand behind the scenes and look, and it's like, okay, wow, you know, that's not right. And to see something that, you know, is not right and you can't do anything about it, it breaks my heart every day. So hopefully with the campaign goals, you know, maybe we'll move some feet, change some minds. You know, I'm not saying, okay, I want $20 an hour. Just pay me what's fair. I'm getting paid $7.75 an hour as a shift supervisor. I was told I was supposed to be getting $8.50. And I approached my franchisee, and he said, yeah, give me some time. He had a year. I think, you know, time is of, you know, you have more than enough time. I have 3 kids and a husband at home. My husband is an on-call job. He's a construction worker, you know, and, you know, times are hard. I have kids to feed, and it's not fair that, you know, you're able to go home with money in your pocket, and I have to struggle, not even check to check, but day to day. And, you know, I don't know what else to say, but I really think it's not fair. How I got involved with the campaign, it was through Community for Change approaching me, and he said, you know, you're supposed to be making more money. I'm like, you sure? I'm like, no, you know, at $7.25, you know, is what I'm used to. It was no problem. That's what they told me I would get hired as. But they said, no, that's not what you're supposed to get paid. And I said, okay, well, you know, maybe we'll step in. But I got pregnant. I took a break from the campaign, and now I'm back. So basically, that's it. That's it.
You are listening to Radioactive. On a week that fast food workers across the country have gone on strike, we hear from a panel on low-wage workers recorded at the Left Forum in New York City this summer. Demos policy analyst Catherine Rudishlin conducted a study in 2012 on low-wage work. The report is called Retail's Hidden Potential: How Raising Wages Would Benefit Workers, the Industry, and the Overall Economy.
But in addition to that, a recent study that just came out from the Senate Democrats shows that the average Walmart store costs taxpayers $1 million per store for subsidies to their workforce because they don't pay their workers enough to survive. So workers are living on welfare. They have, you know, Medicaid and CHIP payments and things like that. Amounts to $1 million per store of taxpayers subsidizing corporate profits so they can get away with paying their workers rock bottom wages. So last year I did this study to see what would happen if we moved away from this financialization business model and back to a model that's old and historically tested, that says if we pay our workers enough to survive, enough to lead good lives, enough to buy our products, we can all thrive. And so what we found in this study is that this new low-wage model is really holding everyone back. It's holding back workers who increasingly live in poverty. It's holding back the firms themselves because they're not making money on revenue growth. And it's holding back the economy overall. One in 10 workers in the economy works in the retail industry, and in combination with fast food, they make up 2/3 of the minimum wage workers in the country. So I looked at what would happen if just the largest retailers, the ones that can really afford it, decided to pay their full-time workers $25,000 a year. $25,000 a year doesn't sound like much. It's one half of the median income in the country. So in a two-income family, that would put you right at the middle, right? And what would happen is, well, clearly it would pull people out of poverty. In fact, it would pull 1.5 million people out of poverty, and it would affect far more people than that. The wage increase would go to up to 5 million workers, people who earn below $12.25 an hour, and people who earn just a little bit above that who would see a wage bump. And we're not talking about, say, teenagers, saving up money to buy a new iPhone. Most of these workers, in fact, 90% of them are in their 20s or 20 or older. The profile for the typical fast food worker is a 29-year-old woman. In retail, it's 35 years old. These are long-term jobs that people think about as their careers. They're not transitional. It's a fairly diverse workforce, about half people of color and mostly female. So a raise to $25,000 a year pulls hundreds of thousands of workers and their family members out of poverty and near poverty, resulting in 1.5 million of Americans seeing a significant change in their standard of living. In addition, because low-wage earners spend their entire paychecks, when they get a few dollars more, they're going to go out into the economy and spend it. That money circulates. It becomes somebody else's income, and then that shop owner needs new employees. It becomes, you know, somebody else's job. A raise like this would generate between $11.8 and $15.2 billion in new GDP for the economy. And because of that, and that's just in the 1 year following the raise, the first year. And in that same year, it would result in the creation of between 100 and 132,000 new jobs. And for retailers, you know, part of that money that people go out and spend is going to come right back to them because most households spend about a fifth of their income on retail goods. In fact, if you're in the lowest quintile, you spend about a quarter. So that means something like $5 billion additional dollars in sales for the retail sector that just spent the money to put the raise. That money goes into their workers' pockets, and then they bring it back and put it right back in the cash register at the drawer. And that's just a tiny fraction of payroll costs and sales at these firms. The truth is, the firms can afford it. They could pay for it all right now just by redirecting their existing profits from the share buybacks that they spend. In fact, the top 10 firms in the retail industry, just 10 firms, spent more money in share buybacks, spent more money last year in share buybacks than it would cost to give a raise to all workers in the retail industry. And that's just 10 firms. So it's totally possible. It results in a benefit for the company and a benefit for the worker and a benefit for the economy overall. But, you know, they wouldn't even have to pay the full bill because in addition to just getting more spending from a pay raise, they also get the benefits of having a workforce that works with dignity, that feels secure, that comes to work and is dedicated to their job. And tons of studies show that paying your workers well means they do better for your firm. So you have a situation where it's like, for example, Costco, which is a warehouse general goods merchandise retail store has an average wage between $17 and $18 an hour. Compared to their low-wage rival, Sam's Club, whose average wage, well, it's pinned at about $8 an hour, but it's a little ambiguous. But the well-paid workers at Costco who have benefits and job security and care about their jobs and want to keep it are twice as productive as the workers. Their earnings per employee are twice at Costco what they are at Walmart, which means, you know, in addition to getting additional spending in the economy, they're actually getting more out of each worker just by treating them well. So, So finally, the last piece that people always worry about when you talk about raising wages is, well, what is it going to cost me? In fact, it only amounts to just a few cents per consumer. A wage raise like this to $25,000 a year for a full-time year-round worker would require consumers like us to spend between 7 and 15 cents per trip to the store. 7 cents per trip to the store. Over the year, we're talking about something like $9 to $19, something like that, in order to have a more robust economy, in order to have a fair work environment, in order to be better served by the places that we frequent. You know, as consumers, we want knowledgeable, dedicated employees to help us and things like that. So the a round benefit for a mere 7 cents. So this is really a unique opportunity that retailers face, that low-wage work employers face. And, well, why don't they do it? Some do. There's a high road and a low road. And there are a few high road employers out there, like Costco, like Quick Trip, like ShopRite, just a few of them. There are more low road employers. But consumers and workers and retailers themselves should really know that this is a possibility. Yeah.
Thank you, Kathy.
Joseph Barrera is a 19-year-old KFC worker in Brooklyn, New York. He also affiliates with New York Communities for Change.
Like I said, my name is Joseph Barrera, and I work at KFC in Brooklyn. And I believe we have the same franchise owner, don't we? So that's kind of like, I guess that's kind of the main story that's going on around here is the exploitation. I mean, poverty is really a cause of that. Forget race, forget, you know, creed, forget whoever you come from. I guess the reason why we're considered working poor is because we're not properly compensated for the fact that we're actually hardworking people. You know, it's not like we sit back and we say, okay, just give us free money because I feel entitled to just survive. I'm actually trying to work, make money so that I can earn the right to buy food, buy clothes, pay rent. I mean, that's really the issue here. But we're not asking to make a six-figure income salary working for KFC, right? It doesn't make sense. We're asking for something that's livable. Now, in New York City, $21 an hour is supposedly statistical, like, I don't know how to say it, how to be out of poverty, whatever the number is, okay? And we're not even asking for that. So our request for $15 an hour and the right to unionize, I believe, is still humble. You know, we're still asking for just enough to get by. And it's wrong that they can't even, I guess, give in to those demands. I got involved mainly because of the fact that throughout my entire life, living in, I guess, a low income, I guess you could call it poverty. I don't like to call it that, but that's just the reality of what it is. I saw it's a more social issue. And I realized that the reason why the economy is so bad is because there's no flow. You know, like, how's the economy going to work if all the rich people are hogging the money? You know, come on, seriously, okay? You want, it's like any system, okay? Like, these lights, they're not going to turn on if there's no flow of electricity, okay? It's going to be dark in here. And that's kind of the society we live in. It's very dark. And I don't understand why we have to, like, really discuss what the problems are. We know what the problems are. It really takes people to want to do something about it. And that's why we're getting together. That's why we're, I guess, trying to form a union. That's why we're fighting for the right and willing to do anything, really, to, like, get the message out there and make people aware that this is what's going on.
This panel was organized by Richard Hill and Scott Harris of Between the Lines, produced at WPKN in Connecticut. WERU is present at the panel, but used Harris's audio for this program. You've been listening to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal produced here at WERU Community Radio.